Well, hello everyone and welcome. I have a popular guest here, Caleb Maupin, who has a new book out, which is called Imperialism and Anti-Imperialism, which is a collection of his writings, lectures that he's done over the course of quite a long career now in political activism. One of the things I like about you, Caleb, is that you're very much a doer, right? You're very much a doer. Now, in my own special way, I'm also a doer, right? I get things done, I do, right? But I also, because I'm an academic and scholar, I tend not to get my hands dirty in actual politics, right? I talk about politics, I analyze it, but I don't do any like organization. Whereas you get yourself out there and, you know, in a way, looking through this book, kind of reminded me a little bit of this is going to sound weird, but do you remember in Forrest Gump, where in Forrest Gump, at every bit of a historical moment, Forrest Gump is there. in a strange sort of way, you're also kind of present. You're there in Occupy, and you're there talking to Putin, and so on and so forth. And you actually sent me a few clips of like a few little greatest hits. Before we talk about this book, I thought it'd be fun to kind of watch them together. So let's have a little watch.
So an email has recently come to light, an exchange between Jeffrey Leeds and former Secretary of State Colin Powell, in which he acknowledges that Israel has, quote, has, he says, 200 nuclear weapons. And the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty has not been signed by Israel. Under U.S. law, the United States should cut off support to Israel because it's a nuclear power that has not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, according to Colin Powell, correct?
Shouldn't you ask Colin Powell that? I'm not going to speak to this particular traffic, and I'm certainly
so
not
going
to discuss.
Israel doesn't have nuclear weapons?
I'm certainly not going to discuss matters of intelligence from the podium. I have no comment on that.
Okay. Well, the email says the boys in Tehran know Israel has 200, all we targeted on Tehran, and we have thousands. I mean, that seems to indicate that there's a knowledge of an Israeli nuclear program, which would make U.S. aid to Israel illegal.
I think I've answered your question.
Okay, well, let me ask, do I have the correct understanding of U.S. law that we're not allowed to support a nuclear power that has not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty?
Look, we obviously support the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. I'm not a legal expert on all the tenets of it, and I'm certainly not going to speak about the details that you've revealed here in this email traffic. That would be inappropriate for me to discuss one way or the other. I'm not going to do it.
There are sanctions imposed on North Korea in response to their nuclear proliferation. There were sanctions put on Iran in response to allegations of nuclear proliferation. And now we have this email from Colin Powell saying that Israel has 200 nuclear weapons. Why is Israel not facing any consequence for this?
That's a very colorful way of getting back to the same question you just asked me. But I'm going to refer you back to the transcript when you see it this afternoon to what I said before to your question. Saeed?
You're familiar with this email, right?
I'm not.
Oh,
I have not seen it. I can't speak to the email. And frankly, even if I'd seen it, sir, I wouldn't engage in that kind of a discussion from the podium.
So, Caleb, can you tell us a little bit about what was going on there?
Well, I was working in Washington, D.C., and we were able to attend the State Department briefings, the daily briefings that they do. And this email had just come out from WikiLeaks showing that, Colin Powell acknowledges that Israel has hundreds of nuclear weapons. And it is illegal under the Non-Proliferation Treaty for the USA to aid any country with nuclear weapons that has not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We had a smoking gun there. We had an email, and you'll notice he just straight up wouldn't, he said, I'm just not going to address that. I'm just not going to acknowledge that. You know, the fact that Israel has loads of nuclear weapons, the fact that Iran has never violated the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and they're not trying to get one. That is like an aspect of this war that we're now in with the United States and Iran that just kind of blows the logic of mainstream media to bits. I mean, the fact that Israel has developed a huge, huge stockpile of nuclear weapons. And there's fear that maybe Iran might get one, possibly, which they have never actually moved toward getting. I mean, that just blows it to bits, the whole logic behind this war.
So then we'll have a look at the next one here, which is this.
Represent what the American people want. All the polls show that the American people don't want a new war. The American people are sick and tired of our money being wasted on bombs and weapons and destruction, provoking a war with China, provoking a war with Russia, while our trains are derailing, people in the United States are suffering, our water's not being purified, our railroads are falling apart, our power grids are falling apart, and yet we pour more and more weapons and money into some stupid confrontation with China. China is not our enemy. Wall Street bankers are our enemy. No more provocations against China. China is not our enemy. 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 Get out of our country. Stop trying to sell war in our country. Stop trying to sell war in our country. We don't want a new war with China. We love America and we don't want a new war with China. China is not our enemy. Stop trying to sell war. Get out of our country. Stop trying to sell war. China is not our enemy. I'm a patriotic American. I love my country and I don't want World War III.
So I have, one of the things I have to ask you, Caleb, is because I would say one difference between us is that I am quite literally allergic to even the notion of going on a protest or carrying a placard.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, when you're in a situation like that and kind of normal people are just trying to get on with life or they're kind of looking at you funny, how do you deal with that? And how do you feel when kind of you're kind of disrupting normal people's lives? Like, how does that feel in that kind of moment? Well,
I think at some points it is necessary to shock people awake. I mean, this was the so-called president of Taiwan. She was touring the United States to call for more weapons to be piled onto Taiwan to threaten China. And so we found out what hotel she was going to be staying at. And we confronted her on the streets and we had our banners and we set up and the international media was there outside of her hotel. And we were there giving the other side of the story. It's wild. They've revealed that since this happened and since situation on Taiwan has kind of escalated, that the United States has a plan that if Taiwan and the Chinese mainland were to go to war, the USA would bomb Taiwan and destroy their computer chip factories to make sure that China doesn't get them. And so I've said many times, think about this. If Taiwan is, America is really Taiwan's friend. If you had a friend who was constantly trying to get you into a fight with someone 10 times your size and trying to, push you into a confrontation with someone who's way bigger than you, are they really your friend? But then imagine that you had a friend who not only was trying to get you into a fight with someone 10 times your size, but then had a plan that if that fight ever happened, they would go to your house and break all your stuff while you were in the fight with them. Are they really your friend? I mean, the USA doesn't really care about the people on Taiwan, and they invoke them the same way that the NATO countries invoke Ukraine, and they're using them as a pawn in a geopolitical game, and it's particularly outrageous. But also, I mean, Americans don't want war overwhelmingly. I mean, we voted overwhelmingly for no more wars. I mean, the polls show the Americans don't want wars. She's a foreigner who comes to America to say, yes, please send more of your taxpayer money, set up more missiles and bombs and weapons in my country. It's not what the American people want. And so I decided to confront her that way and make it more about, look, the American people don't want new wars. You're here to sell a war in our country, and we don't want it. And I framed it that way. There were Chinese Americans who confronted her as well with Chinese flags and all of that. But there, that has a different effect. I was there to say, look, as an American, I don't want a new war with China. You're here to get us into a new war with China. I'm not interested. We don't appreciate that.
Yeah, and, I'm reminded of what happened when, the Assad fell in Syria. And, they install that, what's his name, Jolani, the new guy who's there. And literally within minutes, they were doing bombing campaigns and destroyed basically all of Syria's military infrastructure. Israel did with American help. And then, you know, a week later, that Jalani is shaking hands with Tony Blair as if he's a friend, you know, as if Syria is a friend of the West. And I'm thinking, you know, if I was Syrian, I'd be like, these are the same people who just bombed the absolute crap out of my country, you know, immediately taking advantage out of the out of the ouster of Assad, regardless of whether I liked Assad or not. This is the sort of thing they do over and over again, which I guess you could call imperialism. Before we get on to the book, Caleb, there is a third clip, and I think we should watch it. So let's have a little look.
All right. Some people came here knowing not a single word in Russian, and now they know many. One young person from Kamchatka is sitting in back rows. He's probably unaware of what has been talked about. Please introduce yourself.
Leader of the United States delegation. I'm representing the Center for Political Innovation. And I would like to just thank you from the bottom of my heart for that dynamic interview you gave to Tucker Carlson, in which you showed many, many young Americans a different kind of leadership, because our politicians and our leaders in the United States, they speak in sound bites, they speak in terms of scandal and gossip, but you presented a long-term vision, a scientific view of statecraft, and by getting through to young Americans, you made a difference. Many people who would never have listened to anything you had to say or heard another perspective heard you because of that interview. Now, getting to my question, things between our two countries are not good at this point. You know, before we left, we had to have a press conference at the United Nations. We are concerned about being prosecuted. There are three Americans that have already been charged and are facing prosecution, possibly 15 years in prison, simply because they attended a conference like this in Russia, the Uhuru movement, they're called. And we are concerned because I know that I speak for the majority of the American people when I say that we do not want our tax money dumped into this conflict in Ukraine any longer. We do not want our country to continue to deteriorate internally while our leaders waste money on prolonging this war. I'm frightened by what the Biden administration is doing, not just in Ukraine, but also on Taiwan and on the Korean Peninsula. And I really do see gatherings like this as a potential road to peace. And what I have seen at this festival has blown my mind. The amount of young volunteers that you have here, people who have stepped up, who love their country and want to just come forward and put together dynamic events like this. What kind of role can events like this and young diplomacy activities like this play in helping set the stage for maybe changing the dangerous direction our leaders in the United States are taking things against the majority of the wishes of the majority of the people of our country? Thank you.
The United States of America is a huge and unique country in its own way, over 300 years. In just 300 years, which is a small period of time compared to our history, but thanks to the talents of the Americans, it became a superpower, which is an obvious fact. We know outstanding American politicians. We know outstanding American business people, cultural activists, which is an obvious fact. We used to be allies during two world wars as we fought Nazism and fascism. What happened recently? After the war, after the alliance, the United States and the Soviet Union started dividing the world, and they did so successfully. And based on this balance of powers, they created international relations and created the modern system of international law. Then the Soviet Union ceased to exist for a number of reasons. I will not go into detail, but they were mainly internal reasons. There is one superpower remaining, represented by your country. The way your elites use this monopoly to global domination is dubious. In my opinion, the United States failed to bear this burden of responsibility that they happen to bear. They created monopoly, strengthened it. I don't mean the American people, I mean the ruling elites. While strengthening their monopoly, they soon faced a situation where the overwhelming majority of countries disliked it. And so step by step, it became obvious to everyone that there is resistance to the forming global order. Many, including your allies, they are keeping their silence here. They are afraid of speaking up because they're dependent on major economies, on mass media. There are a lot of dependencies, but believe me, I know what I'm talking about. Even allies dislike it too. And so they faced failures and disturbances. The ruling elites of the United States, after achieving the monopoly of power, decided that the previous system of international relations that was built on the outcomes of World War II is no longer satisfying for them because the balance of power evolved, and hence they decided to change the international legal order. And when it became clear that not everyone is okay with this, by this I mean Iraqi developments. They happened without UN Security Council sanctions. The same applies to Syria, Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia. Without going into detail about root causes, there were no decisions or resolutions of UN Security Council. The United States did let this genie get out of the bottle. If they did so, why can't other countries protect their national interests in the same way? As for Yugoslavia, my counterpart told me on multiple occasions, yes, we did so without UN Security Council resolution, but there was a waging eight-year war, bloodshed. Something must be done. When Russia, however, decided to protect their people in the Donbas, which faced a war with the elderly, with children being killed, why cannot Russia do the same while protecting their own people, not some thousands of kilometers away from their national borders, instead on the border of their own country? And people were waiting for us to help without going into detail. My point is, to understand that the world cannot be controlled from one pole, and which is detrimental to that pole itself as it undermines the foundation. And in the interview given to your compatriot, Mr. Carlson, I said that dollar is being undermined as they forbid to use dollar for settlements. They seek quick results. Instead of gaining one, they only undermine their national currency. They attain an opposite result, and this is true for many areas. In my opinion, this is a wrong policy. But the youth, returning to your question, can do many, many things without interfering in domestic processes, without describing or giving descriptions of the behavior of presidential candidates. It is just a part of the national culture, but youths can contribute in building state-to-state relations. What would be the procedure? They can just speak up domestically, within law, within their constitution. It is the only way, the only option. In no way do we call upon any activities of disobedience, but it is a possibility to speak up in their own country. And I think this is a way to go. In my opinion, this is going to pave the way for non-state forms of contact in order to create conditions for improving relations on state-to-state level, too. Thank you very much for your question.
So Caleb, again, you know, the first question I'm going to ask you is a human question, which is that not many people get to ask a question to a figure of kind of world historic importance like Putin and then get such a long and detailed answer. So how are you feeling when that was happening? Was your heart going or?
Well, that was a long session at the World Youth Festival in 2024, where he just sat there with young people from all over the world and took questions and answered off the cuff, unscripted, unplanned, you know. He's a genius. I mean, Russian President Vladimir Putin is a genius. And, people may like scoff when they hear that. But you have to understand, after the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia was in a nightmare situation. I mean, their economy was in free fall. They were depopulating. People were dying. They were losing, people were just leaving. In the first 10 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, their population decreased by roughly 10%. People either dying or just leaving the country. I mean, it was a disaster. He wrote an academic thesis about how to restructure Russia's economy to build up oil and gas. And he studied, he comes out of the Soviet Union, but it wasn't just Marxist economics. He studied the dirigism, the economic theories of France. Are you familiar with dirigism? And he studied Adam Smith, and he studied various economic theories. And he developed this concept of how you can have a state-controlled mega corporation that can function as what you call a national champion, which is, kind of a state-controlled corporation. And he developed the theory of having Gazprom, the natural gas company, and Rosneft, the oil company, developing them into kind of state-controlled national champions, mega corporations that would be centered, the economy would be centered around. And he restructured Russia's economy in the first years of the 21st century to be centered around these two state-controlled mega corporations, just as he wrote about in his academic thesis. And he did it, and he fixed Russia's economy. And the nightmare of the fall of the Soviet Union was repudiated. And by the time that he'd been in office for 3 or 4 years, the wages of Russian workers had largely tripled. He had, restored the GDP level that they had at the time that the Soviet Union fell. Industrial output was at post-Soviet levels. I mean, he rescued Russia from the nightmare of the fall of the Soviet Union by utilizing the state and by having a government step in and manage the economy. And it was largely, he negotiated. There had been a lot of people who had bought Russian state assets at the time of the fall of the Soviet Union. They talk about oligarchs, and some of them were negotiated with. Others, ended up fleeing the country and becoming, enemies that are, being, harbored in Britain and harbored in America, et cetera. But he got them out of a nightmare by utilizing the state, and that there's an understanding of what government is that is very well alive in Eurasia that we've kind of lost in the West. And that's what I praised him for in my opening comment. It was statecraft, the idea that governing is like a science. Right. It's not, something that, whoever wins the popularity contest and has the most smiley face on TV and, gets wins the electoral dog and pony show gets. It's rather, a science of how do you utilize the state to improve the lives of the people. And he is an effective statesman. I mean, he is not, I wouldn't call him a politician. I would call him a statesman. And he's a very, very effective statesman who has really rescued Russia from a bad situation and enabled Russia to reassert itself and withstand a huge amount of attack. Seeing him engage, the way he can just sit down with students from around the world. All right, next question. Oh, well, and reflect on art, reflect on culture, reflect on anything. I mean, he is just a very serious leader. I don't feel like our leaders in America could endure a kind of, Q&A session like that and just kind of engage the way that I saw him engage. And they wouldn't be willing to. And also the questions they would get from the younger people would not be, questions that would be, kind of productive. But to see him just kind of sit there, I was sitting next to, if you look at in the audience, on one side of me, there was a guy from Serbia. On the other side of me was a woman representing the All China Youth Federation, which is the youth organization affiliated with the Communist Party in China. There were people from all over the African continent. There were people from North and South Korea in the room with me. It was kind of amazing to be there. And this was the new economy. And Russia is a really essential part of the rising new economy around the world.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said that, if I was Russian, it would be almost impossible not to see Putin as a kind of national hero. regardless of what else he does, just for what he did in the 2000s, just for what he did getting Russia out of the Yeltsin nightmare. You know, at the moment we are reviewing the Adam Curtis documentary Trauma Zone, which just shows footage from late Soviet, you know, the Gorbachev era and then the Yeltsin era, and just seeing like what a state the country was falling into and the levels of corruption and things that people don't talk about, like, you know, women casually turning to prostitution because they can't make enough money to live and things like this. And, you know, so if I was Russian, you know, he didn't just restore GDP, he restored, you know, something like a national pride, or because I think the people were demoralized by the Yeltsin years and by the fall of communism. They were actually demoralized for the Russian. It was kind of, that's why it's called trauma zone. It was like a trauma that they went through. And yeah, I mean, I've always said, if you view Putin, you know, take away your cartoon kind of narratives, just see him for what he is, for his own country. And he's, you know, like I said, a figure of a world historical importance. Yeah, I mean, we're going to get to this book in a moment, Caleb. I have to go to my ad break, but there are many more people that you speak to. I noticed that you've got an interview with Roger Waters there. I assume that's the guy from Pink Floyd, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, these are just kind of some highlights that we played, but we're going to get into some of the contents of this new book of Caleb's. First, though, today is pretty much the last day that you can pick up one of my courses using promo code COOL for 25% off. I've been running this sale all of May. Today is going to have to be pretty much the last day. If you excuse me, Caleb, I have to play my short ad, and apologies in advance for the contents of this ad. Everybody wants to be cool. Like this guy. This guy is cool. Do you know who else is cool? People who do courses at the academic agency. And you too can be cool by getting a course today with promo code COOL, which gets you 25% off all courses. Today. Promo code COOL. So there we go. Yeah, you too can be cool. Now, the book looks like this. It's just come out. I mean, this is another question I've got for you. You know, I've written 10 books. I've published 10 books in my career. And I thought, well, I'm pretty prolific. But you seem to bring out books on a very regular basis. How do you manage this?
All right. Well, I have a lot of little pamphlet-sized books, you know, that we've talked about, you know, like little like lectures that I've given that I turn into a pamphlet, or like, you know, shorter pieces. This is very different. This is almost 500 pages. And this is many lectures and many speeches combined into one volume to just kind of give you an understanding of what the Center for Political Innovation, my organization, and what we're all about and what we're doing, to kind of show you the places that I've been over the years and kind of lay out our analysis. And this is kind of a very different volume. I've never published a book like this before, right? I have a lot of different little pamphlets on different topics. I wrote my book about Kamala Harris that went viral during the 2024 elections, I've got things on communist history and the history of Marxism. This is a completely different piece that I put together specifically because we are building an organization and we need to get clear about what we're about. You know, I come out of Marxism. That's my background. But having traveled around the world, I understand things are a bit more complicated than that. You know, the Marxist-Leninist understanding of imperialism is, Lenin wrote about imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism, where bankers become, you know, dominant over industry, the rise of finance capital, the export of capital, where countries are not exporting products, they're exporting the corporations themselves that spread their tentacles all over the world. You know, he talked about the rise of an international financial oligarchy that engages in territorial partition, seizing chunks of the planet as captive markets. That's Lenin. But then later, I learned that in America, right, we have a whole history of that going back to the American Revolution. We have people in our country that called out the British system, right? We're coming up on the 250-year anniversary of the American Revolution. And Henry Charles Carey, who was the economic advisor to Abraham Lincoln, wrote a pamphlet called A Harmony of Interests, where he contrasted the English system with the American system. And he argued that this English system was underworking the Hindu and sinking the rest of humanity down to his level, concentrating wealth in mighty cities, depopulation, desolation, war. Like, he had this whole understanding that Malthusianism, which was being promoted by the British, was rooted in the economic model that they were developing of having a mighty navy that controlled trade routes in order to concentrate wealth into the coffers of bankers based in one mighty city. And he contrasted that with what he called the American system and the economic theories of Alexander Hamilton. He also drew heavily from the German economist Friedrich List, the notion that you should have a national bank. And he talked about the notion of, you know, expanding and equalizing the living standards of humankind, increasing the population, because human labor is the source of all wealth, which is what Karl Marx said. It's what Adam Smith said. It's also what, you know, many of the popes said, that it's human labor power that is the source of all wealth, and that we need to increase the population in order to have more wealth. And that was Henry Charles Carey. And now, you know, as I've gone over to, you know, to Russia, to China, to Iran, there's a rising understanding of geopolitics. And Alexander Dugin has written about Atlanticism and this, you know, the British Empire system being an expression of Atlanticism and civilizations that develop close to the ocean versus civilizations that develop on the great world island of Eurasia. So whether you want to call it imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism, capitalism in its monopoly stage like Lenin, whether you want to call it the English system, as Henry Charles Carey called it, whether you want to call it Atlanticism, this is what we're dealing with. The old order of the world, where it's centered around Wall Street and London and the powers rooted in colonialism, that system is dying. It's dying for very clear reasons, because it can't handle the technological progress that has resulted. It's you know, Marx talks about how capitalism is constantly revolutionizing the means of production and making product labor more and more efficient and making the ability of human beings to create products more and more efficient, which should be a good thing in a rational society. However, it leads to more and more unemployment, less and less room for the worker at the assembly line, and the ability of the worker to purchase the product, the purchasing power of the worker is constantly decreasing. You get more and more economic instability, and that profit is derived from human labor power. And so the less human labor power that goes into production, the less profit there is, the tendency of the falling rate of profit. And you have a problem that that can't be solved. And ultimately, you have these countries around the world that have had revolutions to break out of imperialism and colonialism. They have powerful states that see their job as organizing and managing the economy to increase the living standard, to increase the population, to increase the life expectancy. And those countries are rising, while in the West, we're crashing and burning, and we're having a huge amount of confusion. And if we can understand that, and that ultimately, we need to do the same thing in America. We need to break out of imperialism. We need to break out of this Western financial system that's dying. We need a government that works in the interests of the American people and is not waging wars around the world to defend this dying international financial oligarchy in order. If we can understand that, we could build a real movement that could actually change things. And what's weird is I see myself as taking the best from both the left and the right. I mean, you saw when I confronted Tsai Ing-wen, I said, get out of our country. Right. I'm an American and I don't appreciate you coming here and trying to get us into new wars. I don't think she was coming there to be on America's side against China. I think she was coming there to defend this international system and make money and grift from, you know, the China hating, you know, military industrial complex. And I didn't appreciate that. I see myself as the as building a movement that is an expression of American patriotism. The American people don't benefit from globalism, imperialism. You know, I used to say imperialism, which was the Leninist term. But now if you say imperialism, people think you're doing a woke thing. They think you're talking about white privilege and you're talking about Native Americans or something like that. But if you say globalism by itself, people just think of kind of conspiracy theories. But if you say imperialism slash globalism or globalism slash imperialism, people know what you're talking about. You're talking about an economic system. That's what we're up against. We're up against an economic system that is grinding nations of the world into poverty, which big chunks of the planet have broken free from. We need to break free from globalism, imperialism right here in America.
Yeah, and I'm very interested in Friedrich List. Last week I had my buddy Mike from Imperium Press on, who has published two of my books. So Imperium Press are great. You know, you'd say they're a writer's press, but they bring out a lot of good old books, and he brought out a new edition of List. I think that there's quite a lot of evidence that List was onto something, because it's not just, I mean, everybody thinks of China and Russia, but what about, like, I mean, South Korea is basically, you know, the, I mean, my wife, back when she was working, one of her big clients was Samsung. She went over there and was like, basically, like, well, Samsung runs the country. Like, there's no difference between Samsung and the government of South Korea, right? Or, I don't know, think of something like Norway. Well, I believe that Norwegian oil and the kind of people's, you know, people's savings and the government of Norway are all kind of bound up in one, in a kind of almost nationalistian way. So this is like, clearly something about this works, because each one of these countries in certain parameters China's been wildly successful. I would say Norway's model for managing its energy has been better than Britain's model, which is currently embarking on crazy kind of net zero, you know, anti-growth policies, essentially, under a guy called Ed Miliband. South Korea. And they could say, well, South Korea's got some, you know, negative birth rates and things like that. But if you have a look at where South Korea was before and after they instituted this, you know, it was one of the tiger economies, or one of the great success stories, one of the great capitalist success stories that was sold. But I mean, was it capitalism, or was it really a kind of national economics is what we're looking at? So,
sure. Yeah. Well, no, that's one of the greatest deceptions when you read Milton Friedman and some of the economic literature of people who defend free market capitalism. They'll frequently point to South Korea or the government on Taiwan or Singapore as an example of the free market. And it's just like, those are countries where the government is heavily involved in managing the economy. That's just something that right-wing literature, it's like, well, they're not communists. Okay, that's true. They're not Marxist-Leninist governments, but these are state-run economies where the military is heavily involved in running the economy. And the reason that the USA kind of allowed these countries to prosper was it needed a buffer against communism, right? You know, in South Korea, the reason that Park Chung-hee was allowed to build up first POSCO, the state-run steel industry, and then Samsung and other industries in the 1970s was because they didn't want, you know, North Korea to overtake South Korea. And that there was so much instability, and that the previous military dictator of South Korea, Syngman Rhee, had been toppled. There had been a big uprising because the population was impoverished and they were angry. And there were a lot of people in South Korea, even up to today, there's a lot of people in South Korea that want reunification with the North. There's a big labor movement and others. And so in order to stabilize South Korea, they had to raise people up from poverty. And so, you know, Park Chung-hee utilized the state and the military, and you know, the Kennedy and Johnson administration kind of forced Japan to loan a lot of money to South Korea. And they used the state to build up, in particular, the urban centers of South Korea. And they had a huge amount of success. And then Park Chung-hee got a little too independent, and he said that they would develop their own nuclear weapons, and then that would there be no need for U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula. And you remember that South Korea had their nuclear program, and France put sanctions on South Korea, and then the Jimmy Carter administration launched Korea Gate, and there was a whole scandal about Korean Korean lobbying, Korean, you know, it was kind of like what they did with Russia Gate, about there's foreign influence, and Congress was investigating Korean influence. And then Park Chung-hee, who was the military dictator of South Korea, 1979, he was having dinner with the head of the Korean intelligence agency, and the head of the Korean CIA shot him in the face, and then was executed summarily without ever stating what his motive for doing it was. And people look at that whole situation as very, very mysterious. But basically, Park Chung-hee was taking South Korea in a way more independent direction than the United States would have appreciated. And that you know, at the time of the fall of the Soviet Union, George Soros, he was funding a lot of protests against communist governments, but he also funded protests against the military government in South Korea, against Pinochet in Chile, who had started renationalizing things and moved away from the Milton Friedmanite economics in the 80s, against Marcos in the Philippines. And there were a layer of these kind of nationalistic leaders who the USA had tolerated and allowed to kind of hand out the goods and build up their economy as kind of a barrier against communism. And at the same time that the Eastern Bloc was being gotten rid of, they were also getting rid of those guys. And that's something that the left is not comfortable admitting. They want to say, well, it was just a popular democratic struggle against a dictator. No, it was that these guys like Noriega in Panama, for example, these kind of anti-communist military strongmen, the USA had tolerated their economic policies of development as a barrier against communism, but it saw them as a threat. And the way they stayed in power was not by implementing free market, you know, neoliberal policies and impoverishing their populations. It was by using the military to stabilize the economy and build up development. That if you want to have a society that is stable, people need to see their living standard go up. And that's just a universal rule. When living standards are going down, as they are in the West right now, people get angry about it and they want to do something different and they don't like the government. When living standards are going up, people tend to be more confident and supportive of the state and you have more stability in society. So the USA kind of had to tolerate these countries that were aligned with them, building themselves up. And then in the 90s and late 80s, we saw the USA kind of sweeping those governments away as it no longer needed them as a barrier against communism.
So one question I've got, I have some friends that I can think of who would listen to what you're saying and they'd say, well, yeah, you're right. You know, the America is an empire. You know, we do live under some kind of imperialism. I'm thinking in particular of my friend Richard Spencer, who you may have heard of. But he would say, well, look, yes, there are some issues with the American empire. Yes, but look at all the good things, like shouldn't in the last analysis, doesn't our lifestyle, doesn't all the things that we think of as being great in the West, something like this, doesn't it in some way depend on this? So aren't we getting something from it? And maybe there'd be a British version of this argument as well from various Tories and so on. I basically live in London. So let's grant you all your arguments. Let's say this new world order comes about where, American hegemony falls. How would that be better for Americans, or how would that be better for Brits? Because there are those people who look at the scenario, see what you're saying, and then say, well, okay, maybe they do some stuff we don't like, but what's better for me? What's better for me and my family? How do you answer that question, Caleb?
Well, the main thing to point out is that, that idea that okay, we get something from this. We used to get something from this. That's going away right now. And the most disturbing trend that I talk about in the book is that I would argue that some and a lot of what Lenin wrote in his book, Imperialism and the Highest Age of Capitalism, is a bit outdated, because we're living in a period of what I would call destructive accumulation, where in the past, yes, the USA went around the world, dominating economies. And at the same time, you had a prosperous industrial middle class at home, right? The 1950s, the house and car. And Lenin talked about the aristocracy of labor. You had a layer of well-paid workers in the homeland. And there was stability in the Western countries, kind of at the expense of the developing world. That's not the case anymore. Now we're in a period where the primary way that we're seeing capitalists and wealthy people making money in the West is through destructive accumulation. The amount of value is going down. How many people, how does society become wealthier when people get addicted to opioids and become opioid addicts? Of course not. Does society become wealthier when you have a prison industrial complex where the government is motivated to lock people in jail and increase the number of people locked up? Of course not, right? And that we're seeing that, our country is falling apart. I mean, literally, they're unpaving roads across America. 27 different states have municipalities where the government cannot maintain paved roads. And they have like a machine now that cities can, hire called a reclaimer that rips up the asphalt and pulverizes it and replaces a paved road with a dirt road. And this is happening all across America. I mean, we're getting hollowed out internally because at this point, the system is in this kind of free fall. And this is what Rosa Luxemburg predicted. I mean, she said that this would ultimately be the conclusion of imperialism. That she compared it to the fall of the Roman Empire. I have an article in the book kind of profiling Rosa Luxemburg, where she basically argued this was the ultimate conclusion, and that the war, the constant war, this is like a drug addict, right? You know, when a person starts using drugs, they use it a little bit, to get high, to have fun or whatever, but it gets to the point where they need the drug just to feel normal. And then it gets to the point where that normal that they feel is less and less of a comfortable thing, right? And it gets to the point that even the normal that they feel is kind of a sickly, miserable existence, right? That's what we're in the West. They need these constant wars, these constant injections of war and destruction to stabilize the economy. And it's gotten to the point where, you know, since 9/11, the USA has been at war in a number of different countries, and they need it constantly just to keep the economy going. And as the economy keeps going and we're having constant wars, that normal that we're experiencing with the frequent injections of military hardware, military spending, the frequent, you know, attacks and beating down competitors around the world and trying to push oil producing countries off the market and all of that, that normal that we're feeling is getting less and less stable. I mean, this is the, you know, the era of constant war to keep this irrational system going. And, you know, what I think, you know, that Richard guy and others might be thinking of is they're thinking, okay, well, imperialism is what made the 1950s possible. Well, you could say that, but there are a couple things that are different. One thing that made the 1950s, you know, the white picket fence and the house and the car possible, you couldn't have had any of that without communists. And that's something that people are not comfortable with. But, you know, I hear politicians speak and, you know, it's like they think these jobs are magical. There's something magical about a job at an auto plant. There's something magical about being a steel worker, that you just get paid more wages for it than you do for being a fast food worker. That was not always the case. You know, go back to the 1920s, workers in steel mills made about what fast food workers in America make now, or less than that in some cases, right? These were people fresh off the boat from Ireland or from Italy or from Eastern Europe, and they were making poverty wages. It wasn't until the communists came along and built the industrial unions with the sit-down strikes and workers occupied their factories. 1937, you had the sit-down strike wave, that those places had industrial unions. And then after the post-World War II economic expansion, right, you had the post-World War II strike wave, where those industrial unions that were led had been created by communists. They were kicking out all the communists, but at the same time, they were demanding that amid the huge economic expansion, they get a bigger share of the pie. That's what created that. So that in and of itself was created by communists. And nowadays, those jobs have largely been gotten rid of, not by offshoring, but by technology. You just don't need as many steel workers to make steel anymore. You just don't need as many auto workers to make cars anymore. I mean, it's largely just technology that has reduced that. And I mean, you just don't have that anymore for a number of reasons. And we never would have had it to begin with without a strong left, really without the existence of the Soviet Union. You know, I mean, the 1934 strike wave was kind of a turning point in American history. And it was not actually the biggest strike wave that ever happened. The biggest strike wave in America in labor history was in the 1870s, the railroad workers' strike. There's never been more strikes than that. And it won nothing. It won absolutely nothing. All that came out of it was we got, you know, armories set up all across America to make sure that if there was some kind of labor uprising again, the military and the National Guard would be able to put it down more effectively with armories across the country. It won absolutely nothing. But 1934, the summer of 1934, you had a strike wave where Minneapolis and San Francisco, Toledo, Ohio were shut down by striking workers. And then in the South, you had sharecroppers strikes all across the South. South Carolina declared a state of emergency. And in that moment, President Roosevelt immediately, he passed the Wagner Act, recognizing labor unions. He began hiring the unemployed by the millions in his Works Progress Administration. And that was because those strikes in 1934 were aligned with the Soviet Union that was having an economic boom while the rest of the planet was having a Great Depression. And there was a fear that those strikes could lead to some kind of, you know, Marxist revolution in America. And so in the name of trying to stabilize things, Roosevelt passed a lot of economic reforms, and all of that was in place then at the end of the Second World War, when the economy started to expand again because of all the destruction you'd had during the Second World War, and there was all this room for growth, American workers had, you know, situations set in place where they could maximize on that. And you did have this huge middle class that we had in America that's being gotten rid of. I mean, that house with the white picket fence has been foreclosed at this point. I mean, largely those houses are not owned by individuals. They're owned by banks. You go to, you know, the suburbs of America, the nice houses in the suburbs are all owned by banks. People are renting them from big banks at this point. I mean, the middle class of America is largely gone. The rate of household debt and student debt, I mean, there's just not, we just don't have that anymore, and it's getting worse. And we have an economic system in place where as the living standard is going down, the main way that corporations are enriching themselves is by doing things that make society overall poorer, whether it's the debt industry, whether it's, the addictions that we've got. I mean, it seems like social media is a great example of that. Social media is not making society healthier. Are people getting healthier? I mean, these social media apps are not making our kids smarter. They're not, you know, making the next generation more productive and optimistic. And that we've got a group of financiers that have kind of gripped American politics that as things get worse, they turn it into a mechanism to enrich themselves. I mean, we all know what's going on with the conflict in Iran is that the strait is going to be open. The strait is closed. There's going to be a peace deal. There's not going to be a peace deal. And they're betting on this. I mean, and that is the scandal behind all of this is they're betting on this behind closed doors. And they've got all these mechanisms where all kinds of people that have inside information about what's about to happen are betting on, you know, military spending. I think Pete Hegseth bought a whole bunch of military stock right before Donald Trump came out and said we need to increase the military budget by a third, and that they're making money off of this. It's become cynical and it's fictitious capital, right? You know, they talk about usury. Every major religion, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, has forbidden the lending of money at interest because money that is made from interest, usury or ribald, as they talk about in Islam, that's fake money. It's fictitious capital. No wealth has been created in the process. It's money that came from other money. And the more you have speculative wealth and the more you have money made from other money, the more you get a creditor class that is wealthier than everybody else because they're making money just by having money, number one. But the poorer society gets. And if you don't have a physical economy below that, if you're not actually seeing the amount of wealth in society go up, and you just have a whole bunch of speculative wealth that's made from nothing, eventually your economy crashes and comes crashing down. And that's what we're facing in the West. I mean, we don't have a physical economy anymore. We don't even have roads anymore. I mean, the power grid is falling apart in multiple states. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're decaying. And the solution to this is not going to be privatizations. We need something like, you know, like what they have in Russia, a statecraft to step in and say, no, we need to raise the productivity of society.
I happened to see a documentary or part of a documentary that my brother started showing me about the state of Louisiana, which has suffered from various different floods over the past decade or so. And basically the state has been failed by the governance, by the Republican Party, by just the ruling class in general. And I was pretty shocked by that documentary. And that's why my brother showed it to me. He was like, this is happening in America. It looked like, I mean, genuinely, it looked like something from the third, like what we think of as third world. You look at it and you'd be like, is this Bangladesh? Because, you know, places just haven't, you know, floods came, they haven't been fixed, nothing's been done, roads have been left to ruin and so on and so forth. So that's one thing. Second thing I just want to pick on up on really quickly is that you mentioned the white picket fences in the 1950s. This was something of great interest to me in the past. And, you know, I remember when I was a libertarian, I bought this Libertarians Hate Antitrust Laws. Okay. And I had this this whole book. I still got it here. All about antitrust. And a lot of the book was complaining essentially about inefficient antitrust laws in the late 1940s and the 1950s. Years later, I thought, when I was a libertarian, it was like, oh yeah, this is silly, this is inefficient. Why aren't you letting like the big salt company, you know, why are you keeping the supermarket out there? It's more efficient, blah, blah, blah. You know, I was thinking in that way. But later when I was thinking about it in a more reactionary way, I was thinking, hold on a second. Everybody from Pat Buchanan on down has been trying to get back to that 1950s America. Every one of those little towns, okay, which had their mom and pop stores, the missing component is that Pat Buchanan's childhood was protected by antitrust.
Yeah.
Robust FDR era antitrust laws kept local, like the middle local mom and pop level of business from being steamrolled by massive corporations. So in a, I mean, from a pure free market perspective, is it be like, well, this was an artificial construction. But my, I think, well, yeah, but people really like that. People are fond of that era. So maybe some part of that artificial construction is worth keeping going. Similar thing in this country, right? I mean, my mother grew up in a coal mining town. Now, they didn't have as much money as we do now, or they didn't have, but every single person who grew up in that, in those communities has a genuine fondness for the areas they grew up in. Now, Milton Friedman would say, yeah, but all this was based on a false economy. It was being subsidized. This bit wasn't making money. You know, the government is being used to prop up that bit. But all I'm thinking of, like, if everybody was happier then, surely there's something in that that was worth maintaining or worth keeping. And I've come to the view, Caleb, and you can tell me if you agree or disagree, that, you know, in Europe, they talk about the four freedoms, the four freedoms. You know, freedom of trade, freedom of services, freedom of people, and freedom of capital.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when you join the EU, you get those four freedoms. I have come to the view, and I actually think that people like Adam Smith would actually agree with me in the final analysis, and even David Ricardo, that to have a functional society, the government needs to keep, or some force, whether it's the church, the government, something, needs to keep at least two of those four static, or needs to kind of protect them in some way. Otherwise, the market will continually destroy that, like disrupt and destroy and change those things, such that, you know, if you grew up in a place, by the time you're an adult, no part of it can be remembered because nothing is protected. So I've come to the view that you need to, whichever two of them it is, you can kind of negotiate and argue over that. But if you don't protect at least two of them, you haven't got a country. So that's the conclusion I've come to after many years.
Well, you know, the funny thing about antitrust laws is that, you know, some of them are very essential just to have the market function the way it's supposed to function. Like one of the antitrust laws that exists in America is that if you own a movie theater, you cannot own a Hollywood studio. Now, if you own a chain of movie theaters, you're not allowed to own a Hollywood studio. Well, why is that? Because you would only show the movies from your studio, right? And pretty soon there'd be movie theaters that only showed movies from one studio, and you would have a monopoly, and that would prevent competition among movie producers. And a lot of these laws were written by capitalists themselves just to make their economy work. I used to work in the insurance industry, and the amount of regulations that exist that are not, you know, they're not like a conspiracy, you know, by crony capitalists, and they're not even a capitalist conspiracy against the workers. It's that, you know, the insurance companies have come together and said, in order for our racket to work, basically, we have to have some general rules about how you can sell insurance. And that is one thing that there is this kind of delusion that the Friedmanite Ludwig von Mises, that kind of thinking. I mean, I've heard people say things like there would never be a monopoly if it wasn't for the government. Like, that's not the case at all. Like, monopolies arise naturally all the time, and the state exists to kind of prevent that. And they say things that don't kind of match. It's like the market is magical and always solves problems. And it almost reminds me of the stereotype of your annoying, like, Trotskyite communist. If you ever point to any problem with capitalism, well, that's just not real capitalism. We had real capitalism, you know, and it's almost like, it's like, this is exactly what I see in the kind of the idealistic young Marxist that disavows every communist country. Well, it's just not real communism. Well, you know, so, but when it really gets down to it, I want to be fair though, because the issue with the extreme libertarian free market view on the right, and the left, is that the left and the right both believe in degrowth. That's really the problem. It's not a matter of believing in capitalism too much. The right believes in degrowth in the form of austerity. If we just cut all government subsidies, get, you know, any government spending out of the economy, it'll work. The left believes in state-managed degrowth, right? And we see that, you know, the left wants to reduce. I mean, there was an example of like Michelle Obama was out there saying, oh, we need healthier lunches for kids in school and school lunches and all that. But it was really just to cut the amount of money they were spending on it. And the Democrats have loads of programs they've invented that seem kind of leftist and progressive that are actually degrowth programs. You know, one thing I continue to hear the Democrats talk about in America, and they keep bringing it up. It's a really unpopular idea, but they keep bringing it up because there's big money behind it, I'm sure, is this concept of the National Service Initiative. And it comes up every election cycle that a bunch of Democrats will say, oh, we need a National Service Initiative. Well, what is it? It sounds great, right? It's that our young people, after high school, they should either go into the military or they have to do 2 years of national service where they do good things for the nation. Doesn't that sound great? That sounds like, you know, volunteerism and all that. But what your national service would be, unless you went into the military, you'd be doing the job of a government worker for free. You'd be a sanitation worker or a postal worker for free. And then they don't have to pay the good salary that a government worker would get. And it reduces the amount of government spending because you have a bunch of young people doing it for free as their national service. Well, that's austerity. That's reducing the amount of money in the economy. That's taking good paying jobs with good wages out of the economy. And it's degrowth. And Obama had this program called Teach for America. That's a big program now in America, which is that, you know, if you go to college to become a teacher, and if you're for your first 2 years out of college, you can teach in a low income area. They'll forgive some of your student debt. Well, that sounds great. But what they don't tell you is that for those 2 years that you're a Teach for America teacher, you're getting paid nothing. And you're doing the job of what a teacher with a union pension and wages and union protection would be doing. So it's a way to pay less. And you're basically doing the job of a highly paid teacher for very, very low wages. It's a way to replace good paying jobs with low paying jobs. And that the Democrats want state managed degrowth, often in the name of environmentalism, right? You know, it's, oh, well, you know, the economy, the, you know, the earth, we need to reduce consumption. You know, and that's what the left wants, is state-managed degrowth. What the right wants is austerity, just get the government out. But they both believe that having less will somehow make the economy better. Well, basic mathematics says that if you have four apples and you take two of them away and you have two apples left, you have less than you had before. You don't make the economy better by having less, whether you have the government come in and forcibly make everyone have less or whether you just cut any subsidies. When you have less, everyone gets poorer, and more is better. And human labor power is the source of all wealth. But the Malthusian worldview that has been promoted by the Rockefellers and by the Fabians and by some of the richest people in the world, it believes that the problems of our system are just the problems of humanity, right? There's just too many people out there. And if we can reduce consumption, reduce the population, then we can stabilize things. That's the essence of fascism. And if you read that book I've recommended on this channel many times before, R. Palm Dutt, his very good book, Fascism and Social Revolution. Fascism is when capitalism enters a long-term crisis because of great technological advancements. They get together and they say, okay, we've got to be in charge, right? We've got to keep this economic system, but how do we keep it going? We'll degrow. Will just destroy productive forces to keep the economy going. It's rebooting, an attempt to reboot the irrational economic system with degrowth. And that's the essence of fascism. And around the world, that's what imperialism is. Iraq used to be a stable country that had a state-run oil company that was building itself up in competition with Wall Street. Iraq has been blown to bits. And after Iraq was blown to bits, the oil prices went higher. And all the people that were buying their oil from Iraq had to buy it from ExxonMobil or BP and Shell and Chevron. And it increased productivity. Libya used to be the most prosperous country on the African continent. And they blew it to bits. And ever since the NATO overthrow of Gaddafi, Libya has been a mess of chaos. People have been drowning in the Mediterranean trying to get out. The most prosperous country on the African continent has been degrown, and it was a way to rescue capitalism. Imperialism is degrowth around the world. But we're entering a period of, you know, what we might call fascism, which is degrowth at home, where in addition to degrowing countries around the world, they're degrowing and destroying the middle class at home and driving down our wages. This is all an attempt to save a highly irrational system. The coal miner's riddle, classic story that points to the problem that we're dealing with here. The little boy says to his father, "Why is it so cold?" And the father says, "Because I can't afford to buy any coal." He says, "Well, why can't you afford to buy any coal?" "Because I lost my job at the coal mine. I've been laid off." "Why did you lose your job at the coal mine?" "Because there's too much coal." Right? That's the problem that we're dealing with. Human creative ability has outstripped the narrow limits of the irrational system of profits and command. And you need a state that will stabilize and organize the economy to make sure that we have growth. Self-driving cars shouldn't be a bad thing. Self-driving cars should be a great thing. The idea that this chore called driving is no longer necessary, but in our highly irrational economic system, it would lead to all the truck drivers and all the Uber drivers and all the state highway patrolmen and all the traffic court employees losing their jobs. This is highly irrational. And what we need is a government of action that will fight for working families, a government that will take control of the centers of economic power and utilize them to make sure that we have growth in the long term. We need to be pro-growth. And neither the left or the right is pro-growth. They're both kind of buying into the argument that humanity is the problem and growth itself is the problem. And that is where I disagree. And that is kind of the opposite. And when I go to Russia, I was at the World Youth Festival. Those are gatherings where, you know, the best and brightest, the highest achieving young people in Russia are gathered, and they meet with international guests, and they promote the idea of, you know, use your education and your intelligence to make Russia stronger. And, you know, the Chinese government has 5-year economic plans where they sit down and they say, we need GDP growth in these different areas, and they grow. You look at what Ibrahim Traoré is doing on the African continent, this great African leader. Ever since they took power and they kicked out the French, they've been sitting there and they've been saying, we need to grow. And they've been building fisheries. They've been building power plants. They've been training programs for young people, and they're trying to have growth. Anti-imperialism is fighting for economic growth. And imperialism is degrowth. And that's why I don't talk about communism anymore, because whenever you talk about communism or socialism, it turns into a conversation about making everyone equal. That's what it becomes, right? Is, well, you want everyone to be equal or whatever. I don't want everyone to be equal. I believe in economic growth, and we need a state that actively pursues and creates economic growth. And right now in the West, because of the crisis of our irrational economic system, we have governments that are actively committed to degrowth. Degrowth around the world in the form of war, degrowth at home. And that's what needs to be opposed. We need a pro-growth government. And that's what countries that have broken out of imperialism have. They have pro-growth governments, largely. And that those pro-growth governments now include a market sector, which I think is absolutely necessary. But that's what we need, is a pro-growth government that invests in human beings as the source of all wealth.
One of the interesting topics, I think it's actually maybe the first essay in the whole collection. Yeah, you know, recently there was an extraordinary intervention here in British Britain, where Tony Blair, who you'll remember from George Bush era, right, who was the Prime Minister for 10 years, launched an extraordinary attack on the current Labour government, on Keir Starmer, and basically said that Britain is not growing. That the fundamental problem of Britain is growth, right? And he also said that, we need to cut welfare spending. There's too much money being wasted on this, that, and the other. And that whether we like it or not, AI is coming. AI is coming. We have to get ready. It's going to transform everything. It's going to transform everything. Now, you can see why this is relevant. The very first essay in the book is you saying AI is not the problem. Now, when I hear Tony Blair talk about AI coming down, I think what Tony Blair wants to do is he wants AI to basically transform every sector of society and to gut the civil service and to shrink the state, essentially, by replacing pretty much everybody, doctors, lawyers, teachers, civil servants, councillors. He's like, well, AI can do it. Like, in his mind, AI can do all of this stuff. So it's going to lead to, huge mass unemployment in one way of thinking about it. So how do you say, how does this not lead to degrowth? How does AI, how can that not be a problem in your view?
It's only a problem because of our highly irrational economic system. AI should lead to great abundance for everybody because there's a lot less work that is necessary. And the amount of wealth that can be produced by human labor is greatly expanded because we can have machines do it. And if we had a state that was rationally organizing the economy and making sure that human labor could be expendable and expended in productive ways, making sure we had full employment, controlling our natural resources, we had a national bank that was injecting credits into communities, we would celebrate AI. We would say it's a great thing, automation. Wow, there's less work for everyone to do. The amount of wealth in society is going up. It's only because of the irrationality of profit in command. Technology is not the problem. The problem is how technology is being utilized, and that we have a system where profits are in command and we don't have a state that is managing the economy. Listen to the great classical music, go back to Beethoven and Bach, look at the work of Shakespeare. Did any of that come from the market just naturally creating it? No, it came from governments. The Renaissance, you had governments that said, we need to make the population smarter. It is the duty of the state to improve the population. And so the Tudor monarchy said, we're going to have Shakespeare put on his plays. And, the governments in Germany said, we're going to invest in having music and Bach and Beethoven and all of that. Like, you need a state to invest in humanity and see itself as having the responsibility of making the population better. That is an essential part of any civilization. Forget about capitalism or communism or any of that, right? You need a state that organizes the economy and has the job of making society better. And, you need artists who see it as their job to make the population smarter, right? Nowadays, because art is so commercial, they very much, they want to lower everything to the lowest common denominator to maximize their profits. That's why Hollywood makes the same movie over and over and over again, because a new idea is a risk. And so much of what we have is just purely commercialized. Imagine that we had a social media app that made people smarter and more productive, that made people more optimistic and more hardworking. We could have that if we had a state that stepped in and said, okay, we need to organize things, and that we're being ruled over by forces that are committed to simply turning us into a mechanism to make profits. And there's less and less of a place for us at the assembly line. And their only solution is to drive down our living standards, drive down our wages. They've got, these Orwellian kind of schemes, these visions of, you'll own nothing, you'll live in a pod and eat bugs and you'll be happy about it. They've got these dark visions of how do we reduce humanity so that they can fit into us continuing to rule. Well, if we had a government that actually engaged in statecraft, humanity could flourish and expand, and the amount of wealth in society could be astronomical. And that is fundamentally the issue, is that when you have a society where the profits of a wealthy few are in command, you can't enjoy the fruits of human productivity and human technological advancement.
What are all these people going to do, Caleb? Like, when AI comes, right? We're talking like millions of people. What are they all going to do?
Well,
let's pretend we're rationally organizing it. What are they all going to do?
There'll be less and less obligation on people to do things, right? And the amount of wages that are paid out for doing the things that human beings still have to do could vastly expand because there's so much more wealth being created, and abundance could be there for all. And we are headed toward a society of abundance. It is easier than ever to produce products. It is easier than ever to create wealth, to create electricity, to extract energy. I mean, we are living in a world of abundance. And so why are we living in a world with more poverty and instability than ever before? That shouldn't be the case, right? And that, that now that technology has advanced so much, this is an opportunity for us all to enjoy the wealth that exists. But this is not the world that we're living in. We're living in a highly irrational system where your only ability to survive is renting yourself out to an employer. And that employer only hires you if he can turn your labor into a way to increase his own profits. And if you have that situation, great technological advancements are going to lead to greater poverty and greater instability. We need a state that can rationally manage the economy and unleash the human creative power and the labor power of everybody so that we can have a prosperous world based on human innovation and creativity.
Very interesting. I do see the glowering figure of Carlyle behind us. You're not suggesting, Caleb, that people would just be kind of chilling out with their feet up, because he would say, I mean, I don't want to sound like too Calvinist, but you know, they've got this idea in economics of the disutility of labor, right? That the more you work, the more you feel, kind of feel unease. So you need time off. So there's a kind of you need leisure time as there's a disutility of labor. So if you work an 8-hour shift, you need some rest. Okay. But by the same token, I wonder if there's a disutility of leisure, right? Let's just pretend that nobody did any, like everybody had no work at all. Like I'd be crawling up the walls. I need to do stuff. I need to feel like not in an instrumentalized way, but I mean, productive in the best sense.
Yeah,
I need to feel like I've got a reason to get out of bed in the morning, that I've done something, you know?
Right.
So
the work that you would do, though, would be work that was fulfilling. You would take on, if you're not obligated to work for financial reasons, you're not just clocking in to get money from your employer. If you're working in order to not be bored, if you're working in order to feel fulfilled in your life, you're going to take on things that are much more rewarding for you. Right. And that's, you know, it's funny, you know, Marx himself in the communist in the critique of the Goethe program, he explained that his vision of communism, the higher stage of communism, was a society where labor becomes life's prime want, no longer a necessity, meaning people are working to find fulfillment, like you're describing, rather than working just to pay their bills. Right. And they're no longer alienated from their labor. Rather, they're taking on, you know, they're saying, how can we get rid of poverty? How can we develop a new scientific advance? How can we find a new energy source? They're doing things that bring them fulfillment as a human being. They're not simply clocking in and out in order to get their check.
So it's a kind of economy of self-actualization in a way.
Yeah, where the fulfillment of every individual is the fulfillment of all, right? That's the idea, right? A society where people no longer have to work. So the work that they do is work that is fulfilling and gratifying and enables them to feel more human and more connected with others.
Very interesting, Caleb. Well, where can people get the book?
Well, the book is anywhere books are sold. You can just give them the name, my last name. You can give them the ISBN if you want to pull the ISBN number off Amazon. It's available anywhere books are sold. It's got a lot in there. My talk with Putin, my interactions that I've had over the years, speeches I've given in Iran, presentations I've given around the world. It's got quite a bit. So check it out. Enjoy it. I'm in the Center for Political Innovation is my organization, CPIUSA.org, Center for Political Innovation. We are organizing. We need a movement more than ever to bring America into the new world beyond imperialism.
Fantastic. And I'll just remind people, it is your last chance to pick up a course with 25% off with promo code COOL. It won't work after today. There's a hard deadline on it. So just remind you of that. You've been a fantastic guest. I'm sure I'll see you again. See you again soon. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.